Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the second session of our 2019 Becoming Buddha Immersion in the Dhamma Spring Retreat on May 17, 2019. This talk begins with the Arahant Sutta. In the Arahant Sutta, the Buddha teaches that an Arahant, an awakened human being, has recognized and abandoned the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of stress that follows from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The second talk in our Sangha discussion is on the Paticca-samuppada Sutta. This sutta teaches that the pervasive human condition of ignorance is a cause of all manner of greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. Everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. Information on our retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com. And if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. And when one has seen the five clinging aggregates as they really are, the arising and the passing away, understanding the attraction and the distraction, seeing the arising of desire and the continued delusion, and being delivered from the five clinging aggregates, this one is released from clinging. All defilements are destroyed. What must be done has been done. Perfection is attained. The burden, in parentheses of self, the burden has been put down. The highest goal attained. This one is liberated by perfect insight. That's from the Arahant Sutta, also known as Awakening in a Single Paragraph. It's in all the newsletters, the emails. What the Buddha is referring to there, the five clinging aggregates, are form, this physical form, but all physical form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. And it's that consciousness that is simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the personal experience of suffering. And if you look at each one of those aggregates, we use one or all of them all the time to describe who we are in relation to the world. And we do it to ourselves and to others. We cling these things together. And once they're clung together, we're compelled to keep them together because they're us. Another similar word that has basically the same meaning is karma. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. I won't get too deep into it now. But karma is simply the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated or affected by what we're holding in mind. It's also the five clinging aggregates. Another similar word that basically means the same thing as anatta. The five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of wrong views of self, and it results in that. The Buddha, upon his awakening, as described in the Nagara Sutta yesterday, realized this, and he realized that as this feedback loop of wrong views, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, stuck by name and form, by self-referential views. In other words, these ongoing self-referential views form the container for ignorance. And there is that feedback loop that the Buddha described. And then because of that, the establishment of ignorance manifesting as those fabrications, anything that comes in contact, the sixth sense base, is simply an affirmation of ignorance, an affirmation of fabricated views. Is that clear? Yes. Is it?
Yes.
And I mentioned this to Larry a little bit earlier. Most of the people that come, except the newcomers, you've heard me say this often, it is at the point of contact that the Dhamma is practiced. And you could, with a little bit of an argument, say, and nowhere else. Because even during meditation, when we seem like we're secluded from the world, we really are literally practicing the Dhamma right there. That's the Dhamma. And then off our cushion, we take that well-concentrated mind, that seclusion that we've established on our cushion, out into the world. And like Matt was using that, the euphemism of being in a bubble, that then becomes our protection and our liberation from what's occurring outside, because now we're seeing things clearly. Is that clear? Okay. Well, it'll become more clear now. Thank you. So this is what the Buddha awakened to.
It's called the Paticca Samuppada Sutta. It means dependent origination. Dependent origination does not mean interdependent origination, does it? It's two different words. And they don't, the two different words, they don't even have a similar meaning. Interdependent describes clinging, describes the problem. Another word that's often used to describe in modern Buddhism dependent origination is dependent interconnectedness, that we're all one being. A very famous teacher has made his own term called interbeing. But using the phrase dependent origination to justify this concept of interbeing or interconnectedness or interdependence, and again, it has nothing to do with that. It is so completely different than that, it's hard to understand how people could become so confused about this primary and fundamental teaching until you look at something called the Abhidhamma, which was a very early text. It came in to be included in the canon about 250 or 300 years after the Buddha's passing. But it was written as from a group, from the Theravada group, to start forming a Buddhism that they wanted it to be rather than what it was. And that was the beginning. Well, it wasn't the original beginning. 150 years before that, the Mahasanghikas did the same thing. And they laid the foundation for modern Mahayana Buddhism. All of it was rooted in a desire that the Dhamma be something other than what it is. And so they created these. It's an interesting exercise just to go do an internet search on dependent origination and look at some of the presentations and then compare it to what the Buddha actually taught. And I've yet to come across one. Well, I've come across one. It's on a website called becoming-buddha.com.
John.
Yes.
I think that keeps getting reinforced now too, because there's like evidence in interpersonal neurobiology, the study of that,
yep,
of how we impact one another. So, but if I were going to develop myself based on how everyone was impacting me, then I wouldn't be able to develop myself.
It's the ultimate distraction, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
when enough is released and I'm in a, you know, I'm not saying I'm enlightened because I'm not, but when enough is released and I'm in a compassionate, loving, connected kind of space, I can hold that and work with other people, which I've done for years. But if I was waiting for them to also be in that state of consciousness, then I would never have been able to help anyone.
Yes, and that included in that description is the Buddha's description of the nature of life. Dukkha occurs. Dukkha manifests in other people too. Why? Because they're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. It's not to blame people. But also that whole idea that we're all one being and we're all evolving as one great spiritual cosmic being takes all the responsibility away from me, doesn't it? I don't have to do anything. I have to fit in now to this view of what it looks like to be a good cosmic student. But I'm just donning the robes, aren't I, then?
It's like an escape fantasy.
It is. And it works so well to a mind that's full of grasping and clinging that it's easily adopted because it seems so right. Of course, we're all one. But we're not. We're all individuals trying to develop the Dhamma. It's the understanding of suffering that unites us. It's not just because we're all the same. You can make a physical argument that we are all one, because we are in many sense. We are one organism traveling through space. That's true. So what? That doesn't mean that I have to build my whole understanding on that. That's just a fact of life. Understanding that it's my view of all of that that's occurring, that's the problem. It's not that there's a lack of connection in the world. There's too much connection in the world. The Buddha was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Again, this is what the Buddha awakened to. Friends, I will describe in detail dependent origination. Listen carefully. And what is dependent origination? From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. Does everybody understand that? Simple sentence, it's not that hard to understand, is it? From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. In other words, in order for me to start developing a fabrication means corrupted, perverted. In order for me to start creating a life rooted in fabrication, I must be, it's required that I be ignorant. Ignorance is a requisite condition, and it leads to fabrication. And it's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Now again, this is often portrayed, dependent origination is often portrayed as a creation myth, and the Buddha is describing how everything came into creation. That's where the Abhidhamma influence came from, because that's what it was designed for. And if you read that, you'll see that it's corrupted in a way to account for physical birth, but it has, again, no relation to the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha is simply describing what originates the problem of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. Where does it come from?
Not the physical universe.
He doesn't care. Because why doesn't he care? Most great thinkers feel the need to come up with a description of how and why for everything. The Buddha said everything's already here. I don't have to describe it. I don't have to figure it out. There it is in front of me. What I need to do is understand my place in relation to what's occurring. That's what I'm ignorant of. In a very real sense, I'm ignorant of who and what I am in relation to the world I live in. That's the three marks of existence. From ignorance as a... John, did you have a question?
I did. Can you make the word fabrication a little more concrete?
Yep.
Give me some examples. As I look at myself, or people look at themselves, and they say, what would be an example of, a few examples of fabrications from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths? It's confusion and...
Yes, any... Well, a fabrication is just that. It's something that is made up. There's no real foundation in it, no matter how much I insist that this fabrication that I've developed is real. So a fabrication is a misunderstanding, a corruption, a perversion of what's actually occurring. So a corrupted view, a fabricated view, would be taking anything personal. Because do you see the fabric? There's nothing personal in the world. This might be a little bit more clear tomorrow. We're going to get a little bit deeper into the not self-characteristic. But if there's nothing personal in the world, and there isn't, we are just made up of these six properties. But it's by me, because of a fabricated view, from a lack of understanding of the way things are, that I start personalizing things. I start becoming... living a self-referential life, like we talked about last night. And so a fabrication is simply anything that establishes a self, a permanent self in the world, as this is me. Am I answering your question?
Yes, but I wonder if you could go one step beyond and give me an actual example. You're giving me a great conceptualization, definition.
Well, this house reflects me. And all my accomplishments.
It's a fabricated. It doesn't.
Is me. This lifestyle.
I was treated badly because I did something wrong over and over again.
All of those are examples of fabrication. Yeah. I used to, for when I was a kid, I wanted to be center field for the Yankees. even at 5'7", I thought some miracle I would. So I held on to that thought, and I carried mine. I was a pretty good center fielder. And every time I caught it, made a great catch in center field, I thought, man, I'm Willie Mays, despite skin color. I'm Willie Mays. Or if I hit a home run, I'm Mickey Mantle. I spent my entire life having fun playing baseball, but I was never me. I was always someone else.
That you have control over the aggregates.
Pardon me?
That you have control over the aggregates.
Yes, so no matter how, since I created this fabricated view of me as a 15-year-old center fielder for the Yankees, nobody can live up to that, can they? So I set myself up through that fabricated view for constant disappointment. And when 18, 19, 20 came along and the Yankees didn't call, it came time to pay for that fabrication. Although I still think they might call.
anything that's happening around you in your environment is just happening. It's just arriving.
It's just what's occurring.
Away, it's just what's occurring. The minute that you decide it's happening to me and you react, that's a fabrication.
You take it personally.
And fabrication is reliance on the six senses. What you see, what you hear.
Yes, when our senses are informed by a mind rooted in ignorance, all that they can do is become that feedback loop for more ignorance. Because the interpretation is coming from a fabricated view. But the more important point about fabrication, it relates directly to the Four Noble Truths. We don't understand stress because we fabricate a response to stress rooted in eye-making. We change reality to fit a view of me getting what I need and avoiding anything that I don't want or feel that is going to take away from my peace and happiness and safety. And so we created, that's the fabrication. Now I have established myself in a world in a way that is not true. No matter what I think I might be, no matter how hard I want to believe that I'm going to be center field for the Yankees, the truth is I'm not going to be. And I spent 6 or 7 or 8 years of my life with that one view when I could have just been living my life. I'm using an example that we do all the time. We establish ourselves within a fabricated way of looking at the world. Once that view is established, anything that follows is a fabrication. So again, am I answering your question?
Beautiful.
Yeah, so and there's a whole series of talks and articles, Dhamma articles, on what fabrications are. We're going to touch a little bit more on it. But that really is the problem, isn't it? And it's something the Buddha talked about first. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes this fabricated view. And it's fabricated why? Because of ignorance.
Because
of ignorance.
There is a difference between, or a distinction, I think, doesn't a distinction have to be made between fabrication and aspiration?
Yes, there does. There should be. And we're getting into a little bit. There's skillful aspiration. The aspiring to awaken is a skillful desire. In fact, there's even a word for it, jhanda. So you can't make a blanket statement that all desire is bad either. Skillful desire.
Right.
So right now we are all here because we're aspiring to awaken, aren't we?
Yeah, you probably never would have gotten to the center field if you didn't at least start with that.
Yeah, had to try somewhere. There. Trying to think of what sutta it is. It might be the Magavabhanga Sutta, but I'm not sure. Where the Buddha even says the Eightfold Path itself is fabricated. Well, some people say, well, wait a minute. But think a little bit further. It takes a fabricated structure to recognize what is fabricated. And then post-awakening, the Eightfold Path is no longer part of our fabricated view. It's simply our view. Intention is one of the most important aspects of the Dhamma. And what we intend in this moment is reflected in what we're holding in mind, and what we're holding in mind reflects what we will experience. Reflecting a little bit back on karma too.
So aspiration would have to be rooted in right view?
Yes, and framed by the Eightfold Path.
Because then if it's corrupted by fabrication, then you can fool yourself.
Yeah, and many good examples of that exist. And I'm really not too concerned, as a Dhamma teacher, too concerned about the fabrications that lead to world wars. As a teacher, I'm concerned about that as a human being. What I am most concerned about is to not teach something that is easily grasped on and fabricated that leads to more confusion, deluded thinking, such as me sitting here starting a session by insisting that we learn a chant and do it. And I'm not putting that type of practice down. It's not something that the Buddha taught, and there's inherent eye-making in it. It's fabricated. That's why I don't do it. But that doesn't mean that it's not, that many people see it as a wholesome practice. But that's not a qualification. Just because something feels good or all my friends are doing it is no reason that I should do it. What I found is that I want to be involved in things that fit within the framework of the Eightfold Path, because I found peace and happiness and knowledge and vision like the Buddha did last night. That's how I recognize and abandon fabrications. So what I was talking about a little bit earlier is the Buddha recognized that. That feedback loop that he was talking about of consciousness reverberating against self-referential views is in that first part. From ignorance comes fabrication. And once my ignorance has become fabricated, now it's a thing. Now it's me. And I'm gonna follow through in the rest of these steps that we're going to eventually create confusion, delusion, and stress and suffering in my life.
I like how on the chart there it says mental fabrications. That's an important word, I think, for the context we're looking for.
Yeah.
This is a view that we establish of the world in relation to us, or phenomenon as they relate to us, instead of arriving and passing.
Yep, it's self-created. And again, that's the mental fabrication. We do it. We do it to ourselves, but it also is implied in the Eightfold Path itself. The Eightfold Path takes us from a wrong view, from a fabricated view, to a right view, to a realistic view of Four Noble Truths. And again, they're simple truths, aren't they? Suffering occurs, First Noble Truth. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates that suffering. Cessation of suffering is possible, and the Eightfold Path is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. That's it. That's the understanding that we're lacking. It's not much, is it? And it's not that hard to develop. The Eightfold Path is a path that any human being can develop that has a desire. There's nobody that needs to be excluded from it, except that we exclude ourselves. We simply don't want to do it, or we don't hear about it. One of the most fortunate aspects of my life is I heard about this. There's nothing in the world, in the law, in our constitution, that says that John Haspel has to come across the real Dhamma. Yet I did. I can't think of anything that is more fortunate in my life than doing that. Because it gives me the one thing that I always wanted but never knew where I could really find it. And all of you are here for the same reason. A peaceful and calm mind.
What if you have become the center fielder?
Where would we be?
Maybe
you would still learn to meditate anyway.
You know, I was trying to think of something really funny to say, because I thought about it. What would my life have been like if I was actually 6'2" and et cetera, and I had all the skills? And,
they're not mutually exclusive.
It's not. But you asked the question: Would we all be here? Would I have started the Dhamma? I don't think I would have, honestly, because I know myself that. I think I really would have just gotten caught up in that lifestyle. But I don't know. I mean, that's all speculation, too. So. And we'll talk more about that. Pardon me?
You'd be the announcer of the Yankees about to retire.
I know. Look where I am. I'd rather be here than trying
so
to figure out
what... You could have been the center fielder in the Yankees and still be a student of the Dharma.
Oh, yeah. But the important point is that I wasn't. And I was disappointed. Because I set myself up.
His own question when he said, well, if you have a skill, it's a skillful aspiration if you actually succeed and you had the right view all along.
There's nothing wrong with a young man thinking that he wants to be center field for the Yankees. Kids do it all the time. But on an individual basis, it was a distraction to me. It was an unrealistic distraction from what was occurring in my life at the time. So I loved playing sports. I always did. And I loved playing baseball. What I didn't like about sports is the win-at-all-cost mentality that's so common there. I just didn't like that. So I enjoyed playing baseball, and I got caught up in the competition. But really, in the end, looking back on it, it could have been a much more enjoyable period in my life if I just played baseball and wasn't concerned about all these other things. And I think that's true about anything. When we engage in an activity and our ego takes over and we have to be the best at it, we're losing just doing it, aren't we? I had a friend, a teacher years ago, his name was Arnold Patton. And he loved playing tennis, and he went through a series of things in his life. He was in his early 50s. He was a very famous and well-to-do real estate attorney in Westchester County. And he just got sick of this life, and he started meditating and doing a few other things. And he had a real life-changing experience. He didn't become a true Dharma practitioner, but he had a lot to teach. And he was also an avid tennis player, and he loved playing tennis, but he didn't like the competition. And so post this experience, he started playing non-competitive tennis. He got three or four of his buddies. They get on both sides of the net, and they just try to keep the ball going. That sounds like a lot of fun to me. You know, it's not going to go over too well at the U.S. Open, but, you know. Well, isn't that more fun than trying to beat the other guy's brains in? I think so. Yeah. Okay, we got to try to finish at least one sutta this morning. Let me go back to the beginning, and I'll try to get through this a little bit. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. So look at the progression. My mind is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Because of that, I have an experience in the world. You can think about it as a newborn baby or as a 63-year-old teacher. I have an experience in the world. Because my view is not rooted in reality, it's rooted in ignorance, I create a fabricated view of what just occurred to me. And these are, I'm talking about the most mundane things in the world. We do it with every single thing. Every thought, a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths will fabricate every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it. It doesn't mean that a car isn't a car, a tree isn't a tree, a pillow isn't a pillow. But it means that we're creating a fabricated view of our relationship to what's occurring. There's eye-making in it. People make preferences over all kinds of things, though. Colors, material, different trees. We talked about that. You know, those eye-making attachments are what starts creating stress in our lives. So from ignorance comes fabrications. From fabrications now comes consciousness. Ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's a fabricated way of thinking. Clear?
Yes.
Yeah.
From that type of consciousness, again, I'm saying that because we hear the word consciousness and we think, again, the grand cosmic consciousness. It ain't that. From that type of consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form, comes self-identification. So from ignorance comes fabrications. From fabrications comes a way of thinking that's rooted in ignorance. And now I start self-identifying with what? Name and form. What am I self-identifying with?
Ignorance.
A fabricated view of the world. Does everybody see that? That's now me. This is the self that I've created, rooted in fabrications. From name and form as a requisite condition, from self-identification as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. So every human being has six senses, don't we? The five physical senses and the sixth, consciousness. So the Buddha is not saying that self-identification causes us to have these six senses. In this right context, because of ignorance and self-identification, when I come in contact with the world through these senses, I'm simply furthering my own ignorance. Now, the title of the book is Becoming Buddha. The title of the retreat is Becoming Buddha. The aspect of dependent origination, which is so important, is this is about becoming ignorant and continuing that in each and every moment of our life, unless something interrupts this process. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. Again, it's not a creation myth. It's not to be taken in its literal sense. The Buddha's describing how suffering arises in this environment that we're living in. So out of ignorance, I've created a fabricated view of life. It's informed the way I'm thinking, rooted in those fabrications. Because of that wrong view, I self-identify with phenomena. And because I've now self-identified with phenomena, when I come in contact with phenomena, what do? Come on.
Yeah.
I self-identify with it. Could I do anything else? Given that sequence, this is the brilliance of the Buddha, given that sequence, once I've gone from ignorance to fabrications, the rest of it just follows. It has its own life. And I don't have any choice but to continue to fabricate the fabrications because everything's happening right here. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Good. From that contact, rooted in that sequence, from contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. And so now I'm using feeling. You made me feel awful. Or that idea made me feel bad. Or I feel good about such and such. We describe ourselves always by how we feel, don't we? How was your day? It was just a day. A feeling is just a feeling. We learn that in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. But a mind rooted in ignorance uses feeling to affirm itself in the world and to evaluate what it likes and what it dislikes. But if we're doing that, we're basing our choices in what? In ignorance. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. That's important to note because if I can somehow recognize and diminish reacting to feelings, what does that resolve? It resolves craving. From craving, and if I can do that, I avoid this next step in the sequence. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. Clinging and maintaining are kind of the same thing. I've created a view of myself and the world out of ignorance, out of fabricated views. And now, because of self-identification, I'm now clinging to those views. And once those views in my mind are me, then I have to maintain them, wouldn't I? Because anything else is annihilation. That's why that question comes up when people first start getting a grasp of the Dhamma of what happens when I let go of all self-referential views? What's going to come of me? Don't I need that way of thinking to be established in the world? Yes, you do. We don't want to be established in the world in a fabricated way. We want to live in the world as the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta with knowledge and vision. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. In this sequence, if there's nothing that happens to interrupt this sequence, what is the Buddha teaching us here? From clinging and maintaining, from maintaining fabricated views, from maintaining ignorance comes further ignorance. But if we can find a way to interrupt this process rooted in ignorance and continually reaffirmed by fabrications, if I can find a way to see it and abandon it, then in this moment I can incline my mind toward becoming awakened. And this is where the Dhamma hits the road. It's at the point of contact. This is where we practice. This is where we bring that well-concentrated mind that we spent so many hours on our cushion developing into, so that we can see this process occurring as it's occurring and have the wherewithal, the well-concentrated mind, to practice restraint right here and right now. To recognize a fabricated view arising. How do I recognize it? If I'm reacting to it in one way or another. If it's upsetting me or exciting me, it's a fabricated view. And what do we do with it? If we start analyzing it, trying to figure out where it came from, who's responsible for it. I first thought about this when I was 2 years old. Once we start going down that path, we're lost. Take a breath. Take an in-breath and an out-breath. Now I'm in the moment. Now I can practice the Dhamma and tell yourself, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. And move on into your life. And in that moment, you are using the potential of the moment to incline your mind towards becoming awakened. That's the entire meaning of becoming. And that's the entire choice that we have in each and every moment as Dhamma practitioners. And we can't become too rigid about this. We can become too hypersensitive about, am I practicing the Dhamma right now? But it is in each and every moment. Each and every moment holds the potential to either become further ignorant or become awakened. This is where we practice the Dhamma. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. Again, this is, we don't need ignorance to give rise to physical birth, do we? So, of course, the Buddha's not talking about how the creation occurred. In the context, in the proper context of dependent origination, from ignorance, from becoming ignorant as a requisite condition, comes the birth of further ignorance. That's the most important teaching on karma and rebirth, but just think about rebirth right now. What the Buddhist brilliant breakthrough was, it's not what I'm going to become in a future lifetime if I do a lot of certain things right or gain the favor of certain gods and devas. What's going to determine my experience is what I'm holding in mind in this moment. Because it is in this moment that what I'm holding in mind is going to give birth to the next experience. And if what I'm holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, if I have developed that refined mindfulness, then the next moment will be informed by wisdom rather than ignorance. And I'll be moving myself, my mind, away from the effects of ignorance, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, and towards awakening, towards a calm and peaceful mind. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. I have to be rooted in ignorance if I'm going to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. If my mind is rooted in wisdom, the Eightfold Path, then I'm going to give birth. As a requisite condition, I will then give birth to a moment inclined towards awakening. From that type of birth, as a requisite condition, comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, regret, pain, distress, and despair. So what the Buddha is teaching there is it's not because of ignorance I'm aging, I'm sick, I'm going to face death, I'm upset because I'm not getting what I want, or I'm upset because I'm getting what I hope I don't get. That's the Buddhist description of suffering. It simply means that because my mind is fabricated and I'm reacting from a self-referential point of view, the normal things of life now I take it personal, like getting sick, like aging, like death. You know, if we have a fear of death, it's because we're taking it personal. Doesn't mean we shouldn't make our plans. Like not getting what I want, like getting what I don't want. I react to those things because my mind is rooted in ignorance. And so I create more and continued fabrication for me. I create the reaction. As a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be sickness, aging, death. There's going to be not getting what I want and getting what I don't want. But I don't have to take that personal, because it isn't personal, is it? Getting sick is not personal to me. I'm getting sick because I'm having a human life. Right? There's nothing personal about that. I'm getting old because I'm having a human life. And I can't even say I decided to have a human life, because that's irrelevant. And that leads to all kinds of speculation. Like, we won't have time to get into that, but that type of speculation fuels fabrication. Well, how did I get here? Where am I going? That doesn't matter. That's rooted in ignorance. What's important is you're here. You're having a human life. You're having a human life that is prone to sickness, aging, and death. It's prone through a misunderstanding of being disappointed and distracted by not getting what you want and getting what you don't want. That's the Dhamma. That's the Eightfold Path. But it's because of that I-making rooted in what? Ignorance, that we create these fabrications and so react to normal occurrences in life. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, graying, decline, the weakening of the faculties. Death is the passing away of the five clinging aggregates and the ending of time, the interruption in the life faculties. There's a caution there. The Buddha is also teaching us that we are going to die. Remember the Bahia Sutta. Move! The cow's chasing each and every one of us. We don't know when the next moment's going to come. We don't know what the next moment's going to bring, and it might bring our demise. Better awaken before it's too late. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be. Birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base and the five clinging aggregates. Remember the context. Of course, at a physical birth, it is the appearance of the sixth sense base. But in a mind rooted in ignorance, it's also the appearance of the five clinging aggregates. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. Formless becoming is usually misunderstood. It simply means that we're creating non-physical establishments of ourselves. And that can be through a spiritual practice that we do certain things to improve our lot in a future life, or maybe a life in a million years in the future by doing these different things, something the Buddha never taught, that you can see the eye making in that. And even that's speculative self-establishment in the future. Everybody sees that. If I do these things, if I count to 10 real fast, in the next lifetime I'll be blissful. Okay, I'm going to do the order.
It's like everyone.
I did what I had to do. Pardon me?
Everyone's not wanting to believe that they'll have to let go of living.
Well, and there's also the manipulation of what I'm trying to do. In my mind now, if I can just do this one thing, I can establish myself. I'll be good to go in a couple lifetimes. Right now, it kind of sucks, but if I do this, then that's my reward. That's often called gaining merit. Another misunderstood word. It's just eye making, and it's pure speculation, isn't it? We don't know, and we can never have an experience of a future life. You can't. And a self-referential ego self needs to establish itself throughout eternity.
Yeah.
So it creates a scenario of endless past lives and endless future lives. And what happens to that? When I'm thinking of all the wonderful past lives I had, and it's interesting how past life regression is usually end up, and all these wonderful future lives that I'm going to have, where am I? I've just missed my life. Being distracted by the, and it might even be having these readings and, oh, and the 3 lives ago you had this horrible life and you were, and we, so now we're just dragging that in. But if you do these things, you're going to be the king of England someday. So, well, I don't want to live this life because I'm not the king. I can't wait to get to that life. That's a speculative non, establishing yourself in a speculative non-physical existence. That's what formless becoming means. But it also is the idea in this moment that if I was just a few more inches taller and a little quicker, I could be center fielder for the Yankees. It's the same establishing yourself in a non-physical realm, establishing yourself in your imagination. And I'm trying to bring that whole idea of future life fabrications and past life fabrications right down to the practicality of right now. If I'm thinking I got to be anything other than what I am in this moment, I'm establishing myself in a formless state in my imagination. And it's obviously fabricated, isn't it? Does everybody see that?
Yep. Yes.
And so it doesn't mean that I decided I want to be a brain surgeon, so I'm going to school to learn that. That's something else. That's a practical way of living in the world. And it's not rooted, it might be rooted in eye-making, but the practicality of it is, I'm just doing what I can to learn what I want to learn. There's no eye-making in that unless we introduce it into that. Right? Okay.
But it makes it a lot easier for science people to come and learn from you. Because you're not swirling
yes.
those fantasies up about spiritual matters.
Yeah.
And, my husband, who's a science person, and became more interested in practicing meditation after I found your materials that don't have any of this fantasy spiritual stuff.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's just what the Buddha taught, too.
Yep.
He didn't teach anything that can't be directly experienced right here, right now. The catch to it is that we have to be right here, right now. We have to have the Buddha's teaching is about uniting the mind and the body. One body. Not one cosmic body, one body. A mind united in its body, at peace, at rest, is an awakened mind. It's not that big of a deal, is it? Except when my mind is rooted in ignorance and I've created a fabricated view. How could I get there? I couldn't. When the Buddha awakened, one of the things that he considered for 2 weeks after his awakening was, could he actually teach this? Was there a way to present this to people, knowing what, as in the Buddha's thinking, knowing what I know now about the nature of ignorance, the common human problem, what can I do to pierce that veil of ignorance? And think about it, a mind that's rooted in delusion, how would it know that it's deluded? It's the nature of delusion to not know. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore continued ignorance, isn't it? So the Buddha developed an Eightfold Path specifically for that purpose, to pierce the veil of ignorance, to interrupt this process that we're talking about right now. And he taught no other path. So whenever there's a substitution or an embellishment of the Eightfold Path, you're not likely going to be able to interrupt dependent origination, are you, or practice the rest of the Buddhist Dhamma. That's why those extra practices are fabricated practices, because they're rooted in eye-making. They're rooted in some way of establishing a self in some non-physical realm.
Aren't all religions just
eye-making? Most of them are designed, and again, I'm not putting down any religion, but most religions are about that. They're about doing something now to get our reward in some way in the future. And even modern Buddhism is presented, most of it is presented in that way, a little bit more subtle forms of it, but just that way. That I'm not good enough now, I need to do something and acquire something, whether it's knowledge or enough rituals, to then be an okay person, to then be happy, to be useful in the world, to be. All of that is rooted in a fabricated view, isn't it? Because each and every person is a person. There's nothing anybody can do to make themselves anything other than what they are, which is a person. We're not, I'm laughing because of that whole idea of speculating ourselves into being something else, something with eight arms or something. We're human beings. That's it. And it's not like, well, that's not enough. Of course it's enough. It has to be. Because you can't be anything else. That's the great understanding of a Buddha. What is what it is. But if I'm ignorant of the way things are, then what is isn't that, is it? It's something else. Then, because I've created a fabricated view, then I can be anything I want, including center field of the Yankees, or the King of England in the future life, if I just do a few of these things. It's all fabrication. I'm not living my life. I'm not in my body anymore. I'm in my imagination. But I can carry that imagined view throughout my entire life, can't I? I can live with the bubble. I can live within that imagined bubble. We all do it. Unless we find a way to get out of that bubble. That's the Eightfold Path. Continue. There's a lot of commentary in this too, and it's good to read if you want to. But and what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Find out what time it is so we don't miss lunch. Oh, we got plenty of time. And what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensory stimulus. Clinging to views or conditioned thinking. Clinging to those fabricated views. Clinging to precepts and practices. The Buddha says that repeatedly. That, again, going back to this idea of establishing yourself in non-physical realms. That's all done, almost, not all, but a lot of it is done through modern rituals and practices that were common during the Buddha's time too. If I just do these things, what happens when I do that? I mentioned I took my vows in a particular Tibetan Buddhist school. In that particular school, and I loved it. If I could, you've heard me say it, if I could be a Tibetan Buddhist, I would. I just, the guy, they're so colorful. They have the best monasteries. They have the best hats and those big long horns.
They're laughing.
No, I would love it, but it just doesn't make any sense to me. So I couldn't do it. But anyway, the tradition that I took my vows in has an overarching tradition that when you become serious about the Dhamma, then at that point, you need to start with 108,000 prostrate fold. That means from a standing position, you kneel down, you touch your head on the ground, you lay your palms flat, and you stand up. That's one. You do that 108,000 times, you're laughing, but this is true.
I know.
It's a major, and at that point, now you can start, actually what you would do in that tradition is now you'll start your 3-year silent retreat. You'll begin your Dhamma practice then. And my root guru, I still remember, is Yensei Kenpo Kartha, one of the most wonderful men I ever met. I still get emotional when I think about it because he was just that way. He meant so much to me. But even though he was teaching something that itself doesn't mean much to me, there was such an allure there to be part of that community. But I realized that it was just fabricated. It wasn't for me. It's fine for millions of people. It wasn't for me, because it didn't bring me any understanding. It kept my fabrications going. It kept reaffirming my conditioned thinking. Clinging to precepts and practices, and clinging to a doctrine of self. It's the same thing. Many of these rites and rituals, probably all of them that we're engaging in, is simply clinging to a doctrine of self. The entire underlying doctrine is geared now towards the exact opposite of what the Buddha's teaching, continued eye-making. I'm going to do this thing because it's going to solve a problem. It's going to relieve me from being this not quite up to snuff self, this self-loathing self. How could you be? It used to be many years ago, and this is different now because of the influence of the West. Most countries in Southeast Asia, if you just mention the idea that you're not happy with yourself or you hate yourself or your health, they don't even have a concept for understanding that. How could you look at yourself in any way other than just how you are? Yet we do it all the time. We've created our own type of religion over. We think that if we can find out what's wrong with us, beat ourselves up a little bit, or maybe for a long time, then we can get better. All of that is just a fabricated view. So in order to get better, what we need to do is to recognize and let it go. Get rid of the doctrine of self that's rooted in ignorance. The Buddha continues, and what is craving? There are six classes of craving. There's craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for taste, craving for physical sensation, and craving for ideas. Would everybody say that's true? You've noticed it in yourself?
Yes.
And notice that each aspect of that craving relates to the sixth sense base. And what is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well. Feeling arising from eye contact, feeling arising from ear contact, feeling arising from nose contact, I'm going to go a little quicker, from taste contact, body contact, and from intellect contact. This is called feeling. So the Buddha's pointing to a solution. He didn't quite describe it yet, but he's getting to the point where the solution then is at the point of contact, isn't it? With these senses. And what is contact? Phenomena contacting the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. That's phenomena contacting. And that's, phenomena is just simply everything, isn't it? And everything, you can't point to one single thing in our phenomenal world that's permanent. So all phenomena is impermanent. All phenomena arises and passes away, including ourselves, and the breath meditation that we use is the perfect metaphor and practical experience of life arising and passing away. This is contact with the sixth sense base. And what is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, attention, all the mental aspects of attention, and contact. Discriminating self-referential contact is name. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind, that which makes a physical form, is called form. You'll hear tomorrow in the Dhatuvabhanga Sutta that the Buddha describes the the what makes a person as these six, these four elements, a fifth element called known as space. If you think about that, there can be nothing if there isn't a space to hold it. We can't breathe if we didn't have a space going down into our lungs. There's a space element, and there's a consciousness element. And all six of those are what constitutes a person, but nothing else. So no matter what we can attach to that person, you can never change what that person is, can you? Except by attachment, by the big bag of stuff we carry around on our backs, or the hut full of coconuts so we can have more security than the guy in the next hut. It's all simply acquisition. And there's nothing wrong with acquisition unless we self-identify with it. There's nothing right about it either. It just is. It's just the way a life is unfolding. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to clinging to physical form. Name and form is discriminating consciousness. Discriminating consciousness simply means that we have established a structure to discriminate with or within. I like this, I don't like that. That's what discriminating consciousness means. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to physical form. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness, and those are the six sense base: eye, the ear, the nose, etc. The Buddha teaches that each one of our senses has its own type of consciousness, which makes perfect sense, doesn't it? We've often had the experience that something we smell doesn't quite correlate to what our reaction to it was at the moment. When we start discriminating it, then that's something I do like, but there's something there that I don't like. And we use our senses to do that all the time. Using a pretty gross example, but still common today, all racism is rooted in that type of consciousness, isn't it? There's no real basis for us to see something and then think that it must be different than it is, or it's no good the way it is. But that's just a good example of how we use our conscious, the sense consciousness in a particular sense to follow our thinking. Is that clear? Or did I leave you really confused with that one? As things come in contact with our senses, we interpret it through what we're holding in mind, the present level of our mindfulness. So again, at that point of contact, if what we're holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, then everything is part of our Dhamma practice and leading towards awakening. If not, if we are clinging to ignorance, then what's occurring, no matter how wonderful it is, by the way, can only reinforce that fabricated view. It might be something that makes us feel good, and that's even harder to let go of, especially if we found something that's distracting, but we have given it the spiritual practice label, and it makes us feel good, and a lot of our friends are doing it. It's almost impossible to let it go, unless we have an Eightfold Path to frame it and see it correctly. Sixth sense base. And what are fabrications? There are three fabrications: bodily fabrications, verbal fabrications, and mental fabrications. It simply means that process rooted in ignorance is fabricated through what we are, through our body, through our physical form, through our mental form, and in how we speak. Is always we should talk a little bit about right speech, is always an aspect. If we want to know what our fabricated views are, look at what you're saying to others and to yourself. You'll get a real good view of it. And what is ignorance? Anybody misunderstanding ignorance can't anymore. Ignorance is not knowing stress.
It's what?
Not knowing stress. Doesn't seem like much to be too concerned about at first, doesn't it? Until we realize that the reason why we fabricate the way we do is because we don't understand stress. We think that we can do something about it. We can make it ours. We can make the common stressors in human life fabricated and act the way we want it to act. We want sickness to be not apply to me. We don't want aging. We don't want death. We don't ever want to not get what we don't want. We start creating this process rooted in ignorance. It doesn't matter where the process begins, but for most of us it begins at birth and continues all through life unless, again, something comes here to interrupt it. Ignorance is simply not knowing stress. So the solution is knowing stress. The Buddha said, I teach stress and the cessation of stress, nothing more. Ignorance is not knowing the origination of stress. Where, what originates stress? Craving and clinging. Ignorance is not knowing the cessation of stress. Again, look at how this relates to the entire Four Noble Truths. Ongoing ignorance is a consequence of not understanding stress and having the direct experience of the cessation of stress. We're still rooted in ignorance. Ignorance is not knowing the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress. This is called ignorance. So there's no ambiguity about that. We know what the problem is, and now we know what the solution is, the Four Noble Truths. That's why I say, in order to practice the Buddha's Dhamma, you must keep everything in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. It's going to be the next, probably the next talk. This is called ignorance. The Buddha continues, now, from the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. He's telling us how to get out of this problem. From the cessation, from the remainderless, from the, there's nothing left of ignorance within my thinking. From the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of those fabrications. And once a fabricated view falls away, the entire 12-link chain of dependencies vanishes. And I should say that this dependent origination, for all practical purposes, happens outside of time. It's not something that we can look at in having a linear progression. Of course, it does. But that's just a consequence of it. Our minds aren't quick enough to see that from ignorance in this moment, in the next split second, that whole process of fabrications, consciousness, name, and form transforms itself into giving birth to suffering in this moment. Now, from the remainless fading and cessation of that ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. The Buddha is obviously not saying that we no longer think. It's no longer consciousness rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of fabrications, because I've gained wisdom where there was once ignorance, my thinking rooted in ignorance has come to cessation. My thinking hasn't come into cessation. In fact, my thinking is now skillful and useful thinking that I can rely on to reflect reality. And how do I know that? There's such great comfort in the reason why the Eightfold Path provides such great comfort and freedom is because once we integrate it, and I'm not talking about totally, most all of you have had the experience, I think probably everyone, of just starting to integrate the Eightfold Path and recognizing the great freedom that's within it. Because once we have integrated the Eightfold Path as our way of living in the world, we know we're good to go. We don't have to second guess ourselves. There's no more stress about, am I getting what I want and what I need in this moment? Is something happening? We're simply present. And then each and every moment of our lives is meaningful, no matter what it is. We don't have to search outside of ourselves for more, as another old teacher of mine, Maslow, used to say, peak experiences to identify ourselves, to know we're alive. Maslow didn't teach that, by the way. But we do that, don't we? That's that need for constant sensual fulfillment. We need the next thing.
More.
We need more. Kanasara Bhikkhu wrote a great book based on just that, called the Buddhist Romanticism. Romanticism means we're always looking for a novel way, something new, something I haven't experienced before. The Buddha said, dukkha occurs. What are you looking for? Live your life in peace. You don't have to look for anything. In fact, it's when we stop looking through a fabricated view and start knowing from a wise view that we finally begin to live our lives. Again, each moment becomes meaningful. Think about that for a few moments. Think about how you would live your life if you really were locked into that, experiencing that. Each and every moment of your life was meaningful, completely fulfilling. What would your next moment be like? What would you do? I think it'd smile and just be like a Buddha. What's there to do? And when it was time to get up and do something, you do it. the Buddha was one of the most productive human beings that ever lived too. He didn't spend 45 years post-awakening like that. In fact, he's probably spent relatively little time in meditation. There's no way of knowing, but I would bet just from reading the suttas, he probably didn't spend more than 2 hours a day in meditation, maybe three, but I don't even know if that's true. But he spent the most productive life. Every day he got up off his cushion, he got a bowl of food, he ate it, meditated again, washed himself a little bit, and went and taught the Dhamma. And it's still here today. Every moment was meaningful. From the cessation of consciousness, wrong thinking, wrong views, comes the cessation of name and claim. From the cessation of thinking rooted in fabrications, rooted in ignorance, comes the cessation of name and form, comes the cessation of self-referential views. And that goes back to what I just said. Imagine living in the world without any self-reference. Imagine it. Again, every moment is meaningful. Why? Because there's no self in it. There's no my need, what I need to be happy right now, what I need to be safe and secure or fulfilled or known or noticed. Why would I want to be noticed? I'm just these four elements, space and a little bit of thinking. Nothing else. I can attach anything I want. I can embellish this all that I want. Still going to be me. And why wouldn't I want to be me? Well, because I have a wrong view of self that has led me to thinking that this isn't good enough. Would everyone in this room say that at least at one time in your life you felt you weren't good enough?
Yes.
You know, like, when I wanted to be noticed a lot when I was younger, I really wanted the love and recognition that I didn't receive from my parents.
Yeah.
And acting from that, I got some good things, people who really helped me, and I also got some yucky things, you know,
yeah.
So that's how that goes.
Yeah.
And then learned through that process and got that healed up and then started being able to give myself more and more of that love and carry it within myself. But reaching out from that led me to finding people who helped me to learn how to do that. So sometimes even the wounded part, you know, reaches out into the world to find out how to...
Yeah. Well, it's not sometimes, Chris. That's.
Yeah.
I think that the. Hard to put a number on it, but that's what the great majority of people spend their lives doing, just that, trying to fix what got broke or what's broken. And we've created very useful methods and strategies to do that.
Mm-hmm.
One that comes to mind is mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Yeah.
It's helped so many people. But even Jon Kabat-Zinn is very clear that he's not teaching what the Buddha taught.
Right.
It's one of the things why I think he's really a brilliant man, because he understands that. It's a very specific technique for doing something very well, and it's not Dhamma. It just isn't. It's very similar, isn't it? You know, it's like the same thing. But it doesn't address the problem of ignorance, and that's the difference. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form, from the cessation of self-referential views, comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. So again, it doesn't mean that we no longer have senses. It simply means we're not using our senses in a fabricated way to continue to reaffirm conditioned thinking. That's clear, right?
Yeah.
And again, that is at the point where we practice the Dhamma. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. Of course, we don't lose the ability to touch and feel and interact with the world. But what the cessation of contact means, that now when contact occurs, because my mind is no longer rooted in ignorance, I'm simply seeing things as they are. There's nothing to contribute to any further stress and suffering. That's what the Buddha is referring to as the cessation of contact. It means that it's not my cessation of contact with the world. It means that ignorance has not contacted the world.
Would you say it's not contact, the cessation of the five clinging aggregates, contact with the five clinging aggregates?
Yes. So a mind rooted in ignorance is enveloped in this five clinging aggregates, and it's those aggregates that are in contact with the world. But it's also within the five clinging aggregates that the fabricated eightfold path is applied, isn't it? And those, it's kind of an important thing to understand. Being a five clinging aggregate, it's just a description of the nature of suffering, isn't it? But we could take that, I'm not a five clinging aggregate, I'm not a five clinging anything. It just describes who I am and what I am. And I don't want to identify with that, but I do want to understand it. And I also want to understand that it is fabricated. It's something that I made up. It has a name, which can give it a certain reality and validity, but we understand that the reality and the accepted validity is fabricated, meaning it's of common agreement. And the world is in common agreement. It just doesn't know it. We don't want it. The world is in common agreement that it doesn't know. It just doesn't know what it doesn't know. And so it's looking in the wrong way to always fix a broken self. And again, if you're looking to fix a broken self, you're never going to find the saying that I often use. If you're in New York and you want to get to Los Angeles, but you think you're in Chicago, you can't get there, can you? You have to know where you are, and you have to know what the problem is if you're going to change the problem. So getting distracted in your life and spending your whole life fixing a broken self is just that. It's a perfect strategy to not recognize there's nothing to fix because there's nothing broken. But we can spend a lifetime constantly fixing it, making ourselves feel better, and that's all valuable. There's nothing wrong with that. But you're missing the greater good. Maybe that's the best way to put it. You know, the good is the enemy of the best. It's kind of like that. We get so caught up in making ourselves feel better and fix what's broken that we never get to the realization that, wait a minute, there's nothing really broken in the first place, except the way that I look at it. Even the results of stress are still self-reference. Let me continue. We're never going to get through this morning. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Again, we're just not using thoughts and feelings and contact to reaffirm ignorance. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. So anywhere in this 12-link chain of dependencies that we interact with, that begins to interrupt the Buddha's Dhamma. So we could be, in the moment, being mindful of craving and clinging, the sixth and seventh factors. That's where we're practicing our Dhamma. At other times, it might be right at the sixth sense base. But however it is, at that moment, as we're letting go of fabrications and craving and clinging falls aside, the entire 12-link chain of dependencies falls aside. Why? Because they're fabricated too. And because it's fabricated, it's like foam on the ocean. There's no real power. There's nothing really supporting this except clinging and maintaining. It requires constant attention and constant effort to maintain this thing. That is the true underlying nature of stress that the medical profession is just coming to grips with now. Stress is is involved in nearly every human disease that we have. And we're just starting to get a grip on where it comes from. Stress isn't something that pops up on the road when somebody almost runs into us or we have a nasty conversation with someone, an argument. Stress occurs moment by moment from maintaining a fabricated self. There's an underlying tension that most of us don't even notice until we come into grips with it. We start coming to grips with it. But I would bet most of you started recognizing this in yourself as your minds started to quiet. You realize the tension it creates just trying to maintain wrong views. That's the real prevalent underlying form of stress. It's not the obvious. It's the real subtle forms of stress that we're attached to. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair, and confusion. So again, upon awakening, we are still subject to sickness, aging, and death. There'll still be situations in our lives where we won't get what previously we thought we needed, and we might get what we don't want. we simply will no longer react to them. Our minds will remain calm and at peace. Why? How can we get to the state where we no longer react to what's occurring to us?
By following the Dharma.
But what's the, what have we let go of to get to that point?
Ignorance.
Yeah. And the eye-making that is part of that, isn't it? You all got it. Wisdom brings a cessation to the entire mass of stress and suffering. Wisdom. Wisdom. Not anything else. Not rites, rituals, visualizations. And all those things are fine. Wisdom. And we develop wisdom through the Eightfold Path. And we're here to do that. Does everybody understand now that the problem is ignorance and the solution is the Eightfold Path?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions about this? About the sutta? And you might wonder how it, does anybody wonder how it fits into the Dhamma yet? New people, maybe? We're going to get deeper into this as we go, but this is the context in which to see the Buddha's Dhamma. The problem is ignorance, and it's concomitant eye-making, and a misunderstanding of the three marks of existence.
That chart lays it out pretty well. And the bottom line there, the potential for liberation resides in each moment that occurs. I mean,
yep.
That's Jen, you built that thing, right?
No, I didn't build that.
We all put it together, I think, based on the first retreat that we went through this.
It was a whiteboard experience.
You can follow, you follow the green box, that's the 12 links of dependent origination. And
we just went over.
You know, yeah. If any of those links are broken, sort of what Matt was saying earlier about this burden, or it's almost like a yoke, this chain, and if we let go of the burden, this thing we carry around, if one of those links breaks, and it's a pretty good place to be. You can do that.
Yeah, that's the right word, too. Often the ignorance is called the yoke of ignorance.
That's the main thing.
Yeah. That is. That's the problem. It's a lack of understanding of the way things are. It's not a lack of understanding of how to get to the moon. It's nice to know if you're going to be an astronaut, I guess. But it's irrelevant to us as Dharma practitioners. What we want to understand is the nature of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to that cessation. John.
So, with wisdom, you eliminate your ignorance, because now you apply the Eightfold Path, so the key is wisdom. Now, my doctor said to me, my problem isn't wisdom, it's a lack of compassion. And then he gave me what the Buddha said, something about an eagle, or some Buddhist said about an eagle, that if you're strong, if your left wing is strong on wisdom and your right wing is weak on compassion, you can't fly right.
Yep. So you bring up such a good point, John. There's the Buddha taught that you must marry compassion with wisdom. Or another way to say it is compassion must be informed by wisdom, or it can cause great harm. And I'll give you a good example. There's plenty of them, is the Christian Crusades. That was all well-intentioned, wasn't it? It was thought to be, from their point of view, the most compassionate thing they can do. And yet there was an awful amount of suffering. There wasn't any wisdom in it. And modern jihad is the same way. I'm just using those as examples. I always think of Hitler just because, again, it's a good example. Adolf Hitler believed he was being compassionate in what he did. And yet he killed millions and millions of people. But he believed it. It doesn't make it true, does it? He was being compassionate to his own beliefs. And that allowed him to justify killing millions of people. So compassion without wisdom is not often true compassion. But even in a more mild way, for me to be, often the way compassion plays out today, there's this whole thing, again, I don't mean to sound like I'm beating up everything about modern Buddhism, but I do. My engaged Buddhism is usually just that. It's lacking, it should just be called engaged societal manipulation, really, because it's lacking the wisdom of first developing the Dhamma. Notice that the Buddha was in a position before he awakened. He was a prince in his father's kingdom. He was one of the most powerful men in northern India at the time. And out of his compassion, he could have said, well, I'm in a great position. I'm going to be king one day, and I can take care of, you know, engage in all these different social things and fix all these problems. He didn't do that. He went out and sought understanding. He avoided the idea of manipulating suffering and found a way to bring to cessation our contributions to suffering. That's the difference between wisdom and compassion. And in our interactions with others, we can now help people where they really are. We can meet people at that point because we understand it in ourselves. The most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other sentient beings, you've heard me say this before, is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Why? Because now I know the most effective way to be helpful. And what is the most effective way to be helpful? To be mindfully present with another human being without any fabricated view. Because if I have a fabricated view, and my name is Adolf Hitler, it might be, I'd like to help you, but you're Jewish. Again, I'm making kind of a crazy example, but that's what, how that works. And in that mind that would think that way, that's okay to think that way. It's not, is it? Again, using an extreme view. We can develop a way of being mindfully and peacefully present with each other and express compassion with wisdom moment by moment by simply awakening. And that's what we all want, isn't it? We just don't know how to get it, most of us. We're lucky because we found a way to do that. And maybe I should just talk a little bit more about that for most of the new folks, because you've heard me. I do talk a lot about what the Buddha taught, and I also talk a lot about what it isn't, and I usually give examples, practical examples, because I think it's absolutely necessary, and I learned that from reading how the Buddha taught, because many of us are caught up in other things, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't engage in other practices either. It just means we should understand that this is what the Buddha taught, this is my Dhamma practice. And on Friday nights, I like to get together with my friends and chant for 3 hours. That's great. Really? Or I really like bowing. I think that makes me... I have a good friend of mine who is doing that bowing deal. And he loves it. He says it helps me get focused before I meditate. And, you know, blah, blah.
The what deal?
The prostrations. That's part of his...
Oh, oh.
He's, wow. It's not that lineage. It's another lineage that uses it. But he does that 30 times before he meditates. That's part of his practice. And he loves it. And he asked me, he says, do you think there's anything wrong with it? I don't see anything wrong with it.
Just don't get concentrated?
Yeah, that's what he says. Just understand that it's not Dhamma practice. Mm-hmm. Now, personally, I wouldn't do it that close to a meditation anyway, but it's hard to get it. I want to talk about right speech. How's your right speech going? Well, I didn't mean noble silence. Are you understanding that noble silence is a outcropping, a function of right speech? Without right speech, there is no noble silence, is there? Because there's no container for it. It's just silence. And in some cases, it's forced silence. But when it's noble silence that flows from the understanding in this moment that I don't have anything worthwhile saying, and so I'm going to keep my mouth shut, it's eye-making that says I got to talk about the weather right now, doesn't it? It's somebody who has a calm and peaceful mind that has the restraint to say, I can just be quiet and be okay with that. So how has that been going for you? Well, are you supporting each other?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, good, good. We're going to talk more about that on Saturday night. I think that might be the focus of our talk, maybe, is this right speech. But it is so important. Continue to deepen your understanding of right speech. An important component of right speech is what we're, the speech we're telling ourselves, the story we have going on. Recognize that in yourself too on retreat here. Because you'll have a lot of quiet time. And notice when you have that quiet time, what you're telling yourself, what are you thinking about? Because that's all an aspect of speech and right speech. And if you find yourself judging yourself harshly or somebody else here or your teacher or the food or the ride home or the rain, this is not me, this is not mine. Don't go any further now. Try to analyze it because you'll just get lost. Just remind yourself, it's not you. It's not what you are. And it's certainly not what you're going to become. Thank you for a good session this morning. We have about a half hour. So. I always ask this too. Those that have been on retreat know that I never end a session with just one. So. It might be a little early to ask this, but please tell me at any point the pacing of the retreat is important to me. I don't want to overwhelm you, although almost everybody gets overwhelmed. I really try to, and Matt and I try to have a balance between enough Dhamma to make it a worthwhile retreat, but also enough downtime to integrate it. But don't think that you're going to remember or learn the entire Paticca-samuppada hearing it once. The value in hearing any of these teachings that we're going to get this weekend is hearing them over and over and over again and developing that broad context of what the Buddha taught. Thank you.
If you have the time to read, you can read more about it.
Yes, that's why it's there. Please.
Yeah, investigation.
So you mentioned Thanissaro Bhikkhu.
Yes.
He wrote a book called The Eightfold Path, which is what we're studying here.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be a very consistent and accurate one and helpful.
Thanissaro is one of the foremost Buddhist scholars and teachers. I used to have a little bit of a back and forth going with him, but he, and most of the translations that I then retranslate are from Thanissaro Bhikkhu, and a few other sources. But he still has a view that is rooted in the Abhidhamma that colors his translations. And even that book is a little bit colored by that, by the Abhidhamma view rather than the Paticca-samuppada view. It's not right or wrong either. You know, Thanissaro is a remarkable man. He just teaches something that's different. But that is pretty, his book on the Eightfold Path is pretty close to what the Dhamma is. John.
Teacher, question. Well, I have an aspiration to learn a lot more about the Eightfold Path. Do I get enough by reading your book, or do I need to read this book? In addition, of course.
You won't learn any more about the Eightfold Path by reading any other book except mine. There's a few other good books. That's a good one. Rahula, what's his name? Walpola Rahula. Rahula, I don't know if I got those names backwards, wrote a book called The Eightfold Path too. No, What the Buddha Taught. And that's a very good one. Bhikkhu Bodhi's exposition of the Eightfold Path is a tiny book, is pretty good.
What the Buddha Taught?
What the Buddha Taught is Walpola Rahula's book, and then Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote The Noble Eightfold Path. That's a good one.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, I would get it. But, and not I know the way this sounds, there's enough in becoming Buddha for you to study for the rest of your life, because we can fall into, there's got to be something more. That's an all-inclusive teaching. And the Eightfold Path is simply just this. There's no more instruction that's going to be helpful. What is helpful is to start integrating it. It's the only way.
Practice it.
So you're in the right place, John. You will learn more in this weekend about how to practice than most anybody else in the world today. And I'm not, only because you have put yourself here to do that. And so the charge come Monday is that you just start doing it. You start meditating on a regular basis. We'll talk about this. I want to have a conversation with you before. Pardon me?
Tasks associated with awakening.
Yeah, there's things that you do, but that's all it is. You know, it's just learning it, but it's not, there's nothing that is beyond anybody's capability to understand. But a lot of the understanding comes by experience, not from learning it. But you'll understand that even more.
So are you saying the more you read, the more you discover what it is not?
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot of stuff, so-called Dharma stuff. It's not it. And it's always kind of interesting. But it just keeps giving me an ever more clear view of how brilliant Siddhartha Gautama was. Because we won't get to the sutta where he describes his own process of the six-year search. Maybe I'll try to squeeze it in.
We're not leaving till 9 o'clock Sunday night. Or
11:50. But he incorporated, he's just like any seeker. He wanted to understand. So he grasped onto everything that was out there and every teacher that was out there, and he was brilliant. He learned these things quickly. So quickly and so efficiently and masterfully that two of the major teachers said, "Come with me, Siddhartha. I want you to represent me." I'll make you famous. And he turned them both down because the suttas, the teachings they were teaching didn't lead to his level of understanding. So he understood too that you have to develop this very, very refined focus if you're going to practice the Dhamma. The result of that long search and getting caught in that feedback loop was described in the Nagara Sutta. So if we can finally just settle on this as a framework for our Dhamma practice and not need it to be more, and usually that's fueled by our associations, then we can actually develop the path. But if we're always distracted by what we want it to be, which is what happened with the Mahasanghikas and the Theravadins, they wanted to be different than what an awakened human being taught, then we might have a wonderful life being a Buddhist practitioner. But we're not going to practice, like I keep saying, we're not going to practice the Buddha's Dhamma. We're not going to have that life. And that's, you know, it's our choice how we live our lives. We can do whatever we want. Nobody has to do this. Another interesting thing about the Buddha, I think it's one of the most important aspects of his teaching, is he never saw himself as savior. And he never sought to teach another salvific religion. Why? Because he knew that was ridiculous. You can't make a statement by saying as a consequence of human life, dukkha will occur, and then in the same breath saying, or unless you want to, I can save you from that, meaning you don't have to do anything, just believe in me and follow these commandments, and then dukkha won't occur, or if it does, you'll get rewarded for it later on. The Buddha awakened to the idea that it is possible to end my contributions to suffering by understanding who I am. When I finally understood that, I said, I didn't know it until I read it. I said, that's what I've been looking for my whole life. I don't want all those other things. I don't really care about being center field for the Yankees. Mm-hmm. I want to understand who the hell I am and what's going on in this world. And for the most part, I do. And I can tell you, from somebody who got very excited over just about anything, there's not much that gets to me anymore. The one thing that I notice that really gets me going, gets my frustration up, is when I see obvious systems in place to ensure continued ignorance. That still gets to me. And there's a lot of them around. Mm-hmm. Very subtle, but that's the problem. Yes, Kevin.
Just one thing, you know, I think other members of the Sangha would say this too, but we're fortunate to have this space and to have both your experience, decades of it, and Ram's experience, in knowing the translations, knowing a lot of the other teachers and books and you know, doctrines, and we've benefited greatly from your experience with that and distilling it down into what we have here, what we work with, and I think that's not often recognized, so I just wanted to thank you both for that. And Ram's often input is so valuable.
Yeah, thank you for saying it. We had a little discussion about this last Saturday too, about was there value. I spent many years studying, I think you heard the story, getting more and more frustrated, and then I decided to study only what the Buddha taught. And so somebody said, and it came up in an ancillary discussion, well, wasn't there value in that? And it led you to teach how you teach the way. You understand how important it is to teach that it's this and it's not that. And certainly you can say that, and I feel that. That was my experience. And I teach the way I teach because of my experience, which happens to be very similar to what the Buddha went. He studied all different things, incorporated, tried it, didn't work. I did the same thing. And then he ended up teaching this Dhamma. And when I found that that's what I decided, if I'm going to teach, I'll teach it. But I would have preferred if 30 years ago somebody said, you know, that might not do it for you. Why don't you check out becoming-buddha.com? Because I would have saved. I could have been practicing the Dhamma 30 years ago, you know. And so it's not a regret. It's just the truth. My life is what my life was. It led me to teach in certain ways. But it didn't. It happened. But I don't see any particular value in it happening. It's just that it happened.
Well, it keeps you from straying again.
Well, maybe, but you can't know that. You can't know what you don't know. I don't know that if when I was 25 years old, if somebody handed me Becoming Buddha or The Truth of Happiness or some other book like that, I like to think that it would have had such an impact on me that I would have just, like plenty of people here that didn't have any other Buddhist influence, read the book and took to it right away. So it's just that experience. I had the experience I had the life I had, I don't take any of it personally. I met some incredible people. I could say, well, I'm resentful against, I spent a few years with John Lurie at Zen Mountain Monastery. We developed a great friendship. There's nothing that he taught me in those years that I use today, nothing. But I wouldn't want to change that. He's one of the most wonderful men I ever met. The fact that he wasn't able to teach me the Dhamma or the Dhamma that's useful to me doesn't diminish him in my eyes. I'm just glad that I found it. So as we develop the Dhamma, we understand the difference between acceptance and approval at a very profound level. And we understand we don't have to approve of something, but we accept it because it's there. So I certainly approve of Thanissara Bhikkhu or any of the other Buddhist practitioners. I don't have to approve of them. They don't need my approval. The world doesn't need my approval for them to function and do what they're doing. But I certainly accept them. It's just part of the world.
I think many here want your approval.
I understand that, John. We'll see. There'll be a little test Sunday. And if you meet with my approval, you can come to the next retreat. If you don't, you're on your own.
You got to stay here and get it till next time.
One of the things that Matt and I talk about a lot in our Sangha, we really recognize how fortunate we are that what's developed at Cross River Meditation Center, and that I have, we're always having new people come and join us too. It really is something that is rare. Well, we're going to finish with the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha uses a bunch of accomplished monks and nuns as an example of Dhamma practice, and saying that what you see, the meaning to the audience there, what you see here is rare in the world. Even during the Buddha's time, it was rare in the world to have a well-focused Sangha, and to recognize how fortunate we are to have these teachings. First, 2,600 years ago, in the Buddha's voice, I don't speak Pali, but pretty close. The Buddha's words are what we're listening to. I think that's remarkable. And we're gaining the benefit of it. I think that's remarkable. And I approve of each and every one of you. We've got to go. We've got to have lunch. Thank you all for a wonderful morning session.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.